Hi, this is Heather Esposito, and this is Leadership by Design. Welcome to today's episode of Leadership by Design. Today's guest is Dr. Andreas Hofbauer, who is the founder of Atelier Culture, an organizational and behavioral design studio that works with companies to create cultures and environments in which transformative ideas can happen. Combining organizational design principles and behavioral sciences, Andreas helps build cultures and practices that empower teams to challenge the status quo, pounce on novel opportunities and ideas, and remain cohesive as the nature of how we work together and connect within organizations changes. He's worked with organizations across all stages of growth and development, from established multinationals to startups. And I had a chance to meet Andreas taking a course with some of our colleagues about how to navigate change in the future of work. So I'm really excited to have you as a guest on the podcast today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Really great to chat with you again.
Well, can you share just a little bit more about your background, how you became interested specifically in the topic of change?
Sure. So my background is in organizational innovation and creativity, which means that I focus on how groups and organizations introduce new ideas and practices into their networks, whether it's helping companies develop practices for breaking out of deeply entrenched mindsets or, you know, seeing everyday objects in completely new ways. My work focuses on how knowledge flows between groups, within groups, and then how those groups transform those ideas into new assemblages that materially change how we think about things and act to in our environments. During my doctorate research, I became incredibly interested in understanding why some companies could radically transform categories and typologies over and over again, while others just, you know, were one-hit wonders or could never really get to that level. So, you know, you see this all around us. We see companies that stay persistently relevant while others fall off. Some organizations can transform and evolve and kind of meet those emerging consumer demands and desires, while others just stay locked into one way of seeing their markets and then kind of become irrelevant over time. So I really wanted to understand why companies like Dyson could transform seemingly immutable household objects into new things, why restaurants like Noma could completely transform the way we think about cuisine, how architectural firms can keep evolving libraries, performing arts centers, and companies like Elmhurst can completely pivot from being a traditional dairy to a plant-based company in a like 180 pivot. So that led me to explore a lot of questions around, you know, how do people break out of entrenched ways of thinking to see very familiar things in their environments in new ways? You know, how does knowledge enter into these organizations and their networks? And more importantly, how do these people, once that knowledge enters into organizations, how do they start to recombine that into those new assemblages?
So I guess my big question is, what's the punchline to that? What is the secret between those that are able to do that and those that aren't?
So, you know, there's a bunch of like threads that tie the companies together that can. A lot of that depends on how they think about bringing knowledge into their organizations, being very open and kind of collaborating with a lot of different organizations across a lot of different spaces. So they're constantly exposing themselves to the bleeding edge knowledge in someone else's field, but it's also about the practices, right? It's not just enough that you have those connections. It's how you make sure that people, once that knowledge enters in organizations, have that connective tissue and that cohesiveness through, you know, the practices that the organization espouses, their culture and how they work together, that people then can collaborate and bring those ideas together and kind of make them into, you know, whatever that company's distinctive signatures or way that they approach markets, so they can repackage those ideas into new ways that speak to their, you know, the interesting part of that idea, but then also still embody what makes their company so interesting.
Yes, so let's talk about that a little bit more, because this was something that was really intriguing to me that we spent some time on when you worked with our group. Is I think most people have this impression that if you want to influence change or you want to bring these big ideas in and help them to spread, that the best way to do that is through an influencer. We see that all the time in social media. I mean, they call themselves influencers and we see them start movements. And you're going to have a different perspective on that and want to debunk that myth. Can you tell us a little bit more about why the influencer isn't the key to change?
Right. So yeah, you hit it on, like, this has become such a ubiquitous concept. You see it throughout social media, throughout companies. Now we've kind of come to this notion that if we want to bring about change, we want to make sure that we have that influence or that person who can kind of disseminate ideas. And that holds in some situations, but in most situations, like the ones where you really want to change corporate culture, the way that companies think or act. Meaningful change doesn't happen through influencers. And there's a reason why I'm so adamant about this. Oftentimes when we see change initiatives that don't take off, they don't impact organizations like they're intended to, they don't bring about the change or the objectives, or when we see products fail to catch on, we often think that there's something wrong with those initiatives or those products and services. And I want to be clear, there's a lot of products and services that fail because they're just truly not great. But I see all too often really great initiatives that have the power to really empower their organizations, really impact end consumers. And they fail not because the product or the service is bad or the change initiative within the organization is bad. It's just how they're introduced into networks. So they're not correctly introduced into networks to allow them to propagate and then overturn existing norms. So rather than just going back and trying to figure out how to tinker with a change initiative or the product and service so it can be disseminated through influencers, it's more effective if we start to think about, okay, how are we introducing these ideas, especially those ones that are going to really change how an organization thinks and acts, because they don't spread through organizations like the kind of information that influencers can spread.
All right, so can you make that real for us? Like, give us an example of something where an influencer did work and why, and something where it didn't. Make this real for us.
Yeah, absolutely. So influencers really work when you think about information that we all are familiar with. So if something doesn't really challenge our worldviews, the way that we think about things, influencers can really quickly disseminate information. And this came from a lot of work in the 1960s and 70s in sociology with weak ties, that if people share the same interpretive frameworks, they can really quickly disseminate information across large populations, through society, and through organizations. So let's say it's something like a sales number or a sales figure or something that we should all pretty much know within an organization, an influencer is going to be the person who can rapidly get that across an organization and, you know, get that information to all the little groups throughout the organization. But if you want to think about change initiatives, so you want to think about, you know, changing the way that we think, we act, we behave within an organization, we're going to be met with some form of resistance. So we typically kind of classify those as novel ideas and behaviors, and they propagate very differently through organizations. So for any type of meaningful behavioral change or how we think about things, we need simultaneous exposure to multiple sources of social reinforcement. So that's not the number.
English now. What is what does that mean in English? Simultaneous.
Sure. Simultaneous sources of social reinforcement.
Okay.
So what that means is, you know, we need people that provide us with social proof. Because typically if we have a new idea or a new practice or behavior that we want to adopt, there's some type of cost or some type of resistance associated with it. So we might have costs like financial. There might be psychological, right? Fear, anxiety, discomfort. You know, these new ideas, new ways of acting might be transgressive to our beliefs, or they might really challenge us and be controversial to our belief system. There might be reputational risks within organizations. That's probably one of the most key ones that we think about. We don't want to risk reputational damage within an organization. So there's all these kind of barriers that we need to overcome. There can be real and perceived risks. There can be also that we need to coordinate with people. So there's always some type of resistance that we're coming against, and we need other people to provide social proof to us that the idea has legitimacy or there's efficacy in it, or that there's going to be other people doing it so that we can actually coordinate with those people. So that's where those multiple sources of social reinforcement come from. So for simple ideas that really travel really well through the influencers, those are ideas that, you know, you can have one point of contact. You know, I hear it from you. I can just walk by you in the street. I can hear something that you're saying. If it fits within my worldview, I can pick that up, pass it on to other people. And that's where this kind of notion of viral contagions come from. So influencers in those instances work really well, right? But if you're trying to change the way people see things, the way people interpret things, the way they behave, you need that reinforcement to help people see that there's legitimacy, efficacy, or that they're not going to get any reputational damage by adopting this new way of thinking or acting.
And so if you're encouraging me to try this brand new toothpaste or something that you found that you love, very low risk financially, very low risk reputationally, you could probably influence a lot of people to at least try it. And who knows
exactly
what would happen.
Exactly.
Can you give us, something that required someone to change a worldview or to get those multiple channels of social reinforcement, what's an example you can give us that of where that went wrong that we might all be able to relate to?
So a good example is if you think about how we manage different things. So a big one can be in implementing new management strategies. So typically, if we're going to implement a new way to manage teams, if we don't see other people doing that within our organization, we do come across the risk of having a reputational hit to us that, you know, people think, okay, you're now managing in a different, very different way. If it doesn't work out, people are going to, you know, say, okay, well, it was because you tried something new. But if you see a lot of your peers doing this, you start to see other people doing it. They provide that social proof. So they provide those examples, that proof that we need to see, okay, somebody else is doing this. There's legitimacy in it and there's efficacy, and that there's other people doing it, so that they're also going to provide that kind of reinforcement so that we can start to learn it. And then we can start to adopt it. And then as more people see us adopting it, more people are going to start to adopt similar strategies for management. And that's how we start to get ideas to propagate through organizations. If we just tell someone, hey, here's a new way to manage, you don't provide any social proof, they're going to feel like they're the only one in an organization or a team or a function. And then what happens is that you have all this countervailing forces around you that are going to pull you back to the norms, established norms of the team. So we can never underestimate the power of social norms and kind of that conformity, that when teams have established ways of doing things, if we are the one person going in there trying to change the way things happen, we're going to get pulled back to that established norms. And that inertia is incredibly powerful. That can overpower managers who have a ton of influence, who have a lot of clout within an organization, unless they use coercion, which obviously we don't want to use coercion to lead, right? So if we start to think about this as we want to make sure that there's enough people who start to reinforce each other's behaviors, that's where you start to get people that then can start to overcome those social norms, because then they can start to coordinate with one another. They provide that proof that people need to overcome those risks. We're really trying to overcome resistance. And in overcoming that resistance, it's creating that worldview and changing how we think about something, how we act on something. And anytime we've, you know, tried a new initiative, when we've gone into new organizations, we always feel this when we enter new organizations, and we have to learn new practices and behaviors. It's hard, right? Because we're thinking differently about how we act, how we, you know, think about our markets, and we need other people to kind of reinforce those things. If we're just given, you know, just told to do something, it's really hard to adopt it, because we need to see other people doing it.
And that actually, as you were telling that story, it made me think about 5 or 6 years ago when we were first, I wouldn't even say starting the coaching culture. It was just starting to try and bring coaching in as a leadership skill. And I had one leader that I was working with who saw the potential and said, hey, you can work with the 8 leaders that report to me, and let's see where this goes, and let's see what we can show. And so it kind of started off on this very small scale project. And I don't know, you know, how familiar you are with some of the paradigm shifts that coaching requires, but I would say we had in most organizations, but especially in sales, typically sales leaders get promoted because they're star performers. They're very high performers. They have a lot of experience. And so it was very easy for some of them to fall into, you know, here's how I would do it. Here's what I think you should do. Here's what I know about the client. So more of a telling approach to leading that wasn't inappropriate, because they did have a lot of experience to draw from, but it was a way of leading that didn't necessarily help their people to grow in their own way and to approach things from how they think would be most effective. And so when we first brought this idea of shifting to more of asking versus telling and helping people to self-discover their own way forward versus just giving them the answers, that was a very hard paradigm shift to make. And this cohort of leaders took it on together. But what was really magical, and I had always described it as more of just a grassroots campaign or a grassroots effort, is that those leaders started telling their peers about the impacts they were seeing and how things were different and how their teams were responding to them and how their teams were performing and their teams were more engaged. And all of a sudden, others started saying, I want to hear more about that. How come I haven't been exposed to that yet? And so it kind of spread like a wildfire in terms of having people seeking out how they could learn more because those who had been impacted and had seen positive benefits started sharing it. And it did not come from a top-down approach of this is what we're doing, or we're moving to more of a coaching leadership style. And we're now in the position where it's becoming part of our culture. We've had leaders now for 5 years who have really been investing in their coaching skills. We're now able to credential coaches in-house that are delivering peer coaching to anybody in the organization who would like to work with a coach and have that opportunity. And the Coaching for Leaders program still continues to this day and is one of our most sought after leadership development programs because of how impactful it is. And that's exactly what you're describing. That's exactly how it spread.
Yeah. I mean, you're describing what we call the power of the periphery, right? So in the first example, if you had those sales leaders and they're obviously, if they're successful, they're getting, you know, they're getting promoted, they're getting compensated for that. If you brought into a group of 10 of those sales leaders, somebody with a new practice, all those traditional ways of thinking about how they manage themselves, how they manage their teams, that would overcome this new way of thinking. But what you guys did was you started at the periphery. And that's how most change really happens, large-scale societal change. That's how most change happens in organizations, is that it typically starts at the periphery. So you get a few people who are really attuned to wanting to change. You find those people who are really, it sounds like you found those people who are ready to think differently about how they lead, how they manage. And then you use them to create that kind of cluster. And you create this incubator environment where they can start to reinforce each other's behaviors and practices. They can start to see those wins and get those wins. And then we start to get that social proof. And that's what we mean when we say those multiple sources of social proof. Because as those people started to see success, then they started to inform their colleagues. And then that becomes more like a wave. So typically when we think about influencers, we think about this explosion. But when we try to do that, we often throw people, like in that first example, we'll put one person with a new idea or way of doing it into a group of 10, and they're just going to be immediately brought back to the norms.
I could see that. I could definitely see that.
But if you start like the example that you provided, you start on that periphery, you find those people who are ready. They have few countervailing forces. You incubate that. You kind of keep iterating, testing, building that initiative. You get more of that groundswell, and it becomes more like a wave pushing through an organization. And the more people that adopt it, then you overcome people who have higher thresholds, right? So typically for new ideas, new behaviors that change how we think and act, we need at least two or more sources of social proof, or people who can reinforce our practices and behaviors. But everyone has a different threshold, right? Some things are going to be more, you know, we need to see 10 or 20 people doing it. Some things we only need to see two or three. You know, there's a lot of people with many different thresholds, but as you get more and more people, then you can hit more of those people with higher thresholds, and it just keeps moving through an organization. And then there's a point where organizations tip, right? Once we know that 25 or so percent of a population has adopted new behaviors and practices, we can radically transform established norms and practices. So that's, again, society-wide, but also in organizations. So once we make sure we hit that 25%, then it starts to really cascade out and overturn those norms. So we always want to make sure when we're trying to think about these initiatives, how can we start those somewhere in a smaller, localized place where they're kind of shielded from a lot of those countervailing forces, and then build up enough of that that reinforcement within those groups so that this can really cascade out. Because once we get that 25%, then we have a great chance that this is really going to overturn established norms and become the new practice of the organization.
Yeah, I would say that is definitely true. Those that might have been more resistant, they actually had fewer and fewer reinforcing social proof to remain the same. So as they were looking out to find more people like them that said, I'm just not sure about this approach. What I've done's always worked. It's been successful for me. There were so many more people around them that were saying that the pain of, I think, what is it? The pain of change became greater than the pain of, opposite. The pain of remaining the same became greater than the pain of change.
Right. So it's such a powerful thing to think about change in that way. When we start small, that we can really initiate these groundswells through organizations. And what you then see, which is, you know, proof that you guys have, is that you get that stickiness, right? You go from adoption to something that sticks. Oftentimes when we start to think about change from the center, and you hear this over and over again from organizations and leaders, is that there was all this resistance and they had to put so much pressure on changing. And then once they kind of started to pull back that pressure because they had to focus on a different initiative or they had to move into something else, all of a sudden things revert back, right? Because they've just been holding people with that resistance. But if you start in the other way, like you guys did with this leadership and coaching from the periphery, you have more of that power to allow people to embody it, right? Because then they start to reflect their actions in others. People start to adopt it because, like you said, they start to see, well, there's more proof of this working. I don't need to be fearful anymore of, you know, reputational damages. Maybe I'm not going to get promoted. Maybe I'm not going to get the bonus or the pay raise. So I see proof that the new way works better. And then that's how you get it to stick. And then there won't be any resistance because now people embody this because they see the value of it. They see the upside of it. They see the legitimacy of it, the credibility, and they become then your biggest advocates. Which is the most powerful thing. Once people start to embody it, then you don't need to tell anyone about it anymore. The people within the organization start to become the greatest advocates.
And that's absolutely true. The group that where this has been embedded the longest, as you know, we're undergoing efforts related, you know, to an integration, and the ones that have been embedded the longest are the ones who have called me up and said, you know, whatever happens, please don't let this get lost in everything else. This has been so important and so impactful that it's important. And what can I do to help you if you feel like it is, which has been really validating and comforting to know that, like you just described it, I didn't have language for it, but to say, you know, it's not because I'm out there pushing it. It's that they've embodied it and they don't want that to go away from our culture.
Right.
So let me back up a little bit. I know we talked about the one myth of the influencer. Are there any other myths about change that would be good for us to debunk here today?
Yeah. So, you know, ones that come immediately to mind when we start to think about kind of the influencers, you know, change should start with mass awareness campaigns. So we kind of, we always start off with thinking about, okay, how can we do top-down initiatives? How can we create a ton of awareness around this new initiative? And then hopefully that will create adoption. And then the other one is focusing on individuals rather than the communities that they're part of. So if we start with mass awareness campaigns, we see this all the time, rather whether it's corporate change initiatives, products or service launches, they start with these mass awareness campaigns where they create a lot of familiarity to an idea, but these can also backfire. So if everyone knows about a new change initiative, but nobody's embodying it within the organization, people start to build up resistance to it because they're starting to see it, they're starting to hear about it, but nobody's adopted it yet. And people start to wonder what's wrong with it. And we start to create these artificial barriers in our minds. Maybe that's not legitimate. If I adopt it now, I'm going to be the only one who's adopted it and people are going to look at me funny. You know, the list can go on depending on what the change initiative is. And we often see that initiatives fail because of that, because they've created too much awareness. And then the barrier to overcome that, to convince people to adopt it, becomes too high because they've already had this preconceived notion that there must be something wrong with it, right?
Ooh, I didn't think about that.
Yeah. So like, you know, we see that in organizations, we see it with products and services. So one of the better ways to start change is to think about how can you create, like you did within your organization, how can you start with the small groups? How can you create enough of those people who start to embody this new way of thinking? And through that, they're going to start to create awareness within their groups. And then they're going to create that localized change. And then that will cascade out to it within teams, within functions, and across an organization. And then at a certain point, once you have that 25% tipping point where you know you have, like, these norms are now starting to become more apparent, if you look around an organization, you can start to point at people who are adopting it, who are successfully adopting it and using this new idea, then awareness campaigns become really powerful. But if we start out with those, we often don't have that social proof that people need. At the end of the day, seeing is believing. So if we tell people to manage differently, if we see other people doing it very successfully, then we're going to be more inclined to adopt it. So we always want to start with that small localized before moving to that mass awareness campaign.
Yeah. So how do you balance that? And maybe they're two different things, but how do you balance that with the need for communication? Because when anytime there's a change initiative, no matter what it is, lack of information will create a lot of story that is often not true. So how do you find that nice balance?
Absolutely. So, you know, you take a merger and integration, you have to let people know that something's happening or they're going to find out from the news. So you always have to provide that information. But if you want to start cultural change, you have to pair those together, right? So, okay, we're going to do a merger and integration. but we're also going to change the culture. So start already finding those groups that then can embody it, and then start to get those people to start to build that momentum within those groups and start to expose those to other groups. And that's where we have to become incredibly intentional in how we target, who we target within our organizations, and then how we start to expose those to different people. Because if we do that, then we start to create, again, that social proof that people need. We also, that provides us an opportunity to really start to see how these cultures integrate. Oftentimes when fiercely competitive organizations all of a sudden bind together, they have this myth of, you know, we're competitors, we're adversaries. But if we start to be able to point to groups that are now very successfully working together and saying, okay, yeah, we used to see the market from this way, you saw it from this way, now combined, we have a new integrated perspective that's actually more powerful than we were on our own. And you start to point to those specific examples that can become incredibly powerful. And those people then can become, you know, the people that you point to as examples of the legitimacy and the efficacy of what you're trying to do. And as people start to see that, you make sure they're exposed to people who are really into the integration and see the power of that. And then it will start to cascade out. So you always want to kind of do both at once, like make sure you have the information out there, but already start to seed that change initiative so that people then have that proof. And then you can start to amplify that more and more. So, okay, well, this is the culture that we want to embody. Here are people who are doing it very successfully.
And so what I'm hearing is that providing information is, in your mind and the way you describe it, very different than the mass awareness, like a mass awareness campaign where you're trying to educate through that channel versus just giving the needed information.
Right.
Okay.
You're providing the why, and you're providing that so people can actually see it. It's very hard when we're told, you know, this is what we're doing. This is, that's it. You know, people are just kind of given this, this top-down initiative. But once we start to see people, we can start to embody their practices. And if those people closely resemble us, so we know that the more people are more influential to us, the more dimensions of social life we share with them. So whether that's at work, in our communities, wherever it is, if we share, you know, at work, we have similar positions, we have similar levels of authority, have the same experience or similar levels of experience, we can start to emulate and, you know, try on imaginatively their practices and behaviors in ourselves. So it becomes more of a easy transition to adopt that new practice and behavior. Whereas if I see someone who's completely unrelated to me in the organization doing it, it might become a lot harder because they might have very different commitments, very different concerns. So I might not be able to adopt that same practice or behavior in the same way. But if we start to provide enough of those contexts where we can see it from the leadership perspective all the way down through different groups, then people can start to see, okay, these people are doing it very successfully, but they also represent me. I can see myself and their actions. So it's a lot easier for me to adopt those actions and those practices and behaviors because I see how it fits within their commitments, within their level of seniority, within their level of influence, and what their trajectory is within the organization. Because obviously something from the executive leadership team, they're going to have very different core commitments and expectations than someone who's just starting off a career at Herman Miller or another organization. So we need to make sure that we provide that proof across the different levels of an organization.
So that makes me think about something like culture. The coaching program started off as a program and a skill set and competency that we wanted people to have. But if you didn't have it, I mean, we were still leading teams successfully. We were just trying to add something else. With something like culture, what's the risk that you run into? Or maybe it's, I don't know, I think that's the question I want to ask. But so I'm working with a small group intentionally on the culture that we want to roll out. What's the risk of not addressing that with the rest of the organization? Because in the lack of intention, something else could pop up that we may not want. Is there a risk there, especially with something as important as culture work?
So, you know, you always run the risk that, you know, if you start things on the periphery, that, you know, the people who are still embodying the old practices and behaviors are going to further entrench themselves. We see this all the time in society, within organizations. As they see change happening around them, they start to further entrench into their old practices and behavior. We see this around changing to hybrid models of work. Mm-hmm. We see this when there's massive changes within industries, that those kind of people within organizations that are more comfortable with their past practices, they start to retrench. And while we're trying to do work on the periphery, they might further entrench themselves. But if we're really, you know, bringing these ideas in the periphery together, and we're making sure that we're giving them to people, and we're finding those people who are most poised to want to change their organization. And we make sure that they have those connections, not only within their groups, but then those cross-cutting ties and those multiple cross-cutting ties to different parts of the organization, we can really start to cascade these changes out. And then we can even overcome the most entrenched people and the way that they think, because we're going to start to create more of that social proof that there's something going on here. So while, yes, we might still have people kind of digging their heels in on the other side of the organization, we see this time and time again. If we seed it properly through the periphery, we're going to create that momentum, and that's going to create more and more of that social proof. And then at a certain point, once we get to that 25%, you're going to start to create that social inertia that pulls people towards the new norms. And that's what kind of tips societies, that's what tips organizations to like do radical changes and pivots. It's just making sure that we get enough of those people. Oftentimes when we see this fail, it's because we have only 20%, 18% people in an organization. That just is shown across study after study that's not enough. So we always need to make sure we're really focusing on that periphery, because if we make sure that we get 25, 30% people adopting something, then all of a sudden we have the power to overturn really deeply entrenched established norms within organizations. And then we can propagate those new cultures that we want, those ideas that we want, or the new way of thinking and practicing, right? Because that's constantly changing within an organization, right? The environment changes, our competitors change, the needs of our clients change. So we're constantly trying to seed new ways of thinking, new ways of acting, new ways of behaving, as the environment that we operate within changes.
And so somebody who may, for whatever reason, say I just need to reach everyone. I really feel like that mass communication campaign is going to be faster, quicker. And may be afraid of the periphery of saying that may be too slow, or I'm afraid about what's happening on the other side. You would still advocate, if you really want lasting change, that the more effective, slower is going to get you to the finish line that you really want.
Absolutely. So if we think about a leader, they're kind of, it's like this hub, and then they have all their spokes, right? Because they're all connected to everyone in the organization because they're their leader. They don't have those tight connections with everyone. That's just a pragmatic thing. Mm-hmm. If you have a smaller organization with maybe 15 people, yes, a leader can go through individual by individual and try to change their mind's parts. But they're also probably more connected to the leader. They probably have tighter relationships. As we start to go to organizations with hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of people, they don't have that level of connection. People aren't able to empathize their actions and their relationships with them. So while they might be very well intentioned in trying to reach everyone, people can't model the senior director's new way of thinking or what they're trying to get across to us in our own actions. So it's a lot harder for us to adopt it, because it just doesn't situationally and contextually fit with us. If we think about all the major changes, if you think about Oatly, that didn't start with mass awareness campaigns. That started by small coffee shops in the Northeast. They provided it to customers, and all of a sudden, in 2 years, that created one of the greatest crazes in plant-based milk. If you think about Twitter, that started in small, very hyper-localized groups of students in San Francisco and Cambridge, Massachusetts, before it became really prominent, and then they were on Oprah. But people often think, oh, it was Oprah that popped them. No, it was all this stuff that happened before. And you see that in organizations as well. It starts by people at the periphery, and it might seem intuitively, it doesn't seem like it's the fastest way, right? Because it's going to be slower.
Yeah, it feels completely counterintuitive.
Right. It is. But you're going to get that adoption, right? Because okay, Now we can start to model our activities and our behaviors and the other people. We're more influenced by them. And we're going to be able to really change. And while we see change from coming top down, sometimes it doesn't model exactly what we want, because people have resistance to it, because they're like, okay, well, this is kind of feels coercive, or it feels a bit manufactured. If we start to do it from the sides, if we start to do it from those peripheries, we can really start to embody those behaviors. And then people start to really start to reflect it. Their peers who they're more closely related to, who share more social dimensions in their organization, they can reflect those activities. And then what we see is this, a more groundswell. So they're more effective at getting adoption. Even more important than adoption, you get the stickiness, because now people embody these practices and behaviors and they take them on as themselves. Now that's how they see how they should act and how they should behave. So they become the greatest advocates, and then they start to become pulling those people who are resistant in. So while a mass awareness campaign might be very effective at bringing information to everyone, they're very ineffective at changing, ways of thinking and behaving when they really meaningfully change how we think and act.
It makes complete sense to hear you describe it. It just still feels completely counterintuitive.
It's definitely counterintuitive. It plays with, we've always thought about ideas working from influencers. We've always thought about ideas can just be mass transmitted. People like Malcolm Gladwell on Tipping Point, you know, he starts his book off with this notion that, you know, behaviors, products, fads, they can all transmit like viral contagions. And it's like this intuitively simple idea, and it's beautiful. We've all had the common cold and see how that rips through our offices and our communities. So we have this familiarity with this notion of viral contagions. But that, again, only works when things are simple to digest. There's something that fits within our pre-existing interpretive framework. But when we're talking about culture work, changing the way we interact, especially now where we're thinking about moving to hybrid models, and that's completely changing the way we think and work within organizations, you can't do that just by disseminating it out like that. Yes, it's good to give people information so they know where the organization is going. The last thing you want is to keep people in limbo. But you want to also then start to show how that's working, how these new practices are going to be rolled out. Because then people can start to model it, they have that social proof, and then they start to adopt it. And then that starts to have that cascade across the organization.
The other myth you mentioned was this idea of individual and community. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. So we often think about, and this goes back to the previous question, right? Like we try to go to individual, and it's really hard to change a large organizational social network by going individual to individual and saying, hey, you need to connect in this way, or hey, you guys should be transmitting knowledge in this way. And we see these initiatives all the time, right? We're going to try connecting people across an organization so that they share more information, so that we can get people who have those, you know, those practices that we want. Maybe they'll share them with someone on the other side of the organization. We try to focus on individuals. And while the individual should always come, you know, be the most important thing, we also need to realize that they're embedded in groups, right? Everyone in an organization is embedded in multiple different contexts within organizations. And people are very, you know, they're driven by their social surroundings. Who's around them, that's who influences them. So who they're connected to influences what ideas are available to them, what actions and behaviors are appropriate and which ones aren't, and what resources they have access to. So those are both, you know, material within an organization, but also social, what kind of status, power, influence they have. So rather than trying to focus on individual by individual, if we start to look at the clusters and the groups that they're connected in, and we start to change those, it's again that you can create that more lasting and that lasting change. Because you're starting to think about how people influence each other. So if I find that context, I find those people that are most likely to want to take on a new practice or behavior, I'm going to be a lot more successful in getting those people to reinforce each other's behaviors. Then they can start to coordinate with each other, because a lot of, you know, when we think about changing how we interact, how we think about things, new behaviors, there's that learning curve, right? And that can be steep, it can be long. And we want to make sure that people have that, those peers around them to reinforce those, to coordinate, to learn from. But if we go individual by individual, we kind of leave people isolated and we treat them as isolated individuals. Whereas if we go into those contexts, we can create those reinforcing mechanisms of social reinforcement.
That makes complete sense. This is a leadership podcast, obviously. And so if a leader is listening and is thinking right now, how do I support myself to be an agent for change, whatever that change may be, whether it's a process, whether it's, you know, culture, big or small, how does a leader go about that?
Sure. So that's a great question. So if a leader is trying to, you know, we can look at that from two perspectives, right? If a leader is trying to impact their colleagues, so other leaders, there's one way of approaching it. And if the leader wants to influence change with those people who report to them, yeah, I often think about leaders in those positions and that ladder where they're trying to influence those people around them, that they're trying to lead, that they're not, you know, necessarily the change agents, but they're more facilitators of change. And that's because they're starting to be more intentional about who they find within their groups. So within their teams, within their functions, within their regional groups, whoever rolls up to them, they're finding those people that are very ready to take on new ways of thinking, acting. Those people who are most excited about a new cultural change, they're trying to find those people and then trying to find where they sit. Do they have those relationships with other people that they can start to coordinate with so that they can start to reinforce each other's behaviors and that they can start to, you know, bring in these new practices to the groups? How are they connected to other people? So in those roles, I see leaders more as you know, curators and facilitators to make sure that their teams are positioned in the right way. And we can become very like, you know, tactile and, you know, removing those people out of the group for a bit to provide that social incubation and provide that coordination and then slowly reintegrate them into the group to provide that cascade. But in those instances, I see, you know, them as more facilitators. If you're thinking about how are you going to get other leaders, you know, in your, you know, your peer group to change, you want to start to find those people like you, that think like you, that you have connections with, that want to also bring about change. And then you want to start to work with them to think about these ideas. Your example of how you bring about, you know, change with the leadership and coaching, you find other leaders within the organization that see, okay, yeah, this could really impact my staff. This could really empower us, this function, this team, this whatever it is. You find those individuals and then you start to work with them so that they can start to build those practices into their teams. And then you're going to have colleagues that you're going to show this work off to. You're going to show them the impact, the success that you're having. They're going to want to learn about it. And after learning, they might become more poised to adopt it themselves. So you want to start to become that change agent who looks through your peers. Who can I connect with? Who can I work with to build this up? Because especially if you start to link this across different functions, different teams, different regions, it creates even more legitimacy. Because then it's not, oh, this just worked in Heather's group. No, this works in a lot of other people's groups in this organization. So there's legitimacy because it's coming from different sources. So now you create this, you know, okay, I'm seeing this happening in a lot of other places. So there's legitimacy across the organization. And that's how you can really start to bring about that change. So you can become that change agent.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about the difference between how a leader influences their colleagues versus direct reports. And you bring up a really good point, because I know there have been times in my career where I've heard other people, when it's cascaded down from your leader, you kind of sometimes wonder a little bit about the legitimacy. Are you doing this because you have to and it's the thing you were told to do? Or is this really something that you're taking on because it's genuine for you? So I think sometimes there's always a kind of a question to the motive about where that's coming from. So I liked what you pointed out about, it may not even be somebody who's a direct report on your own team, but where you're influencing almost third party and that's a much different relationship and a much different power dynamic than with your colleague. And so I hadn't really thought about the differences there.
Yeah, and no matter how well-intentioned an organization, we're always going to have those questions, right? When we have information coming top-down. Because again, are the people that we report to, the people, you know, that report to us, they have different circumstances, they have different commitments, they have different metrics that they're measured across. And, you know, it could be a very well-intentioned thing, but that already creates a barrier where they can't relate it to themselves. So mm-hmm. If you start to become more of those curators and figure out, okay, who in this group is going to be the most poised to want to take this on? Who are they connected to that might also be poised to want to take this new idea on, and then couple those people together to reinforce each other's behaviors, start to show that change, and then they can start to become your biggest advocates. And then it's more an embodied thing that people take on for themselves and they see it. And then it becomes such a quick thing to pass through a group because it's, okay, I'm seeing my peers who I can immediately reflect their actions on my own. We're all measured against similar metrics and it's working for them. So I should probably start to adhere to this. And we can pull that social power. So it's more, again, that the managers in those situations become the curators of change.
I love that word. And I will say I've probably fallen into a false belief just as part of my leadership development work. I so believe, you know, about the power of a leader and their influence on their team and what a responsibility that is for a leader to really take that seriously. And through every leader in the organization, we can reach every employee, and that there's also some potential drawbacks to that when we're looking at change. That's probably a false belief I kind of came into this call with that you're making me rethink as a result of this discussion. All right, well, as we start getting close to the end today, one of the things that we like to ask our guests, because we talk about leadership development a lot, is, what are you working on in your own leadership development right now? What's calling you to your own level of new greatness?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've had an incredible, opportunity and experience over the past year. I've been working with a coach of my own for Ironman races, and they've really brought me to new levels and pushed through a lot of emotional, physical, and mental barriers.
Yeah.
interest in how they explain things to me. So it used to be for years I worked with coaches that thought about like the what and the how, which is really helpful, right? But the way that the coach has now framed it is more of a why and connecting the larger picture. Because when we think about this stuff, we're not talking about a 2 week, 3 week, 4 week, we're talking about year, 2 year programs. And when you're really in the worst parts of what you're doing in training, you start to need to understand how those little moments fit into the larger picture. Mm-hmm. And he's been so incredibly powerful in creating those narratives around how every day, how it all builds cumulatively, even when you don't want to do it, when you feel resistant, when, you know, whatever it is, creating those narratives. And I found that so incredibly powerful for my own journey that I've been really trying to bring that into my own client work. So I've always been an advocate of providing education as much as I can, as much as people will listen to me in the organization, so that when I leave, that, you know, there's no dependency. They can continue these initiatives. They understand exactly what we were doing, why we were doing it, so they can keep building it. But now realizing that so much of that is creating those narratives around the why and how those small daily, you know, points of resistance, trying to get people to change, how that fits into a larger picture so that they can communicate that onto their, you know, their employees, their teams, so that they also have those narratives to see how this, how everything links up into this bigger picture, especially when change is kind of glacial and happens over time. So that's been something that's really challenged me and been a really fun journey to take.
Yeah, that ties so much into really the core of the work that we try and do. It's kind of two different pieces. I mean, first of all, one of the things that we talk a lot about with our leaders is the inner game runs the outer game. And that's exactly what you're talking about. I mean, you can get out there and somebody can take you to the gym and say, do this exercise to build your stamina, or today you're going to run this far, or do whatever. Yeah. If your mindsets and you don't have that straight, like, it will impact your behavior, because at the end of the day, how mature this level of consciousness is will impact your performance, trumps it every single time. And if we're not doing that work, we can only physically train so much to where it'll outstrip us.
Yeah, exactly. It's this kind of like cognitive shift in how you frame the situation, right? From like the here and now to, okay, there's a bigger picture and these small incremental gains will have massive cascading impact. And there's a reason why I'm here and what I'm doing and how I'm doing it.
Your purpose has to exceed your fear. I mean, because there's a part of you that will always, talk about that part that pulled you back with change. It's that fear narrative. What if you're excluded? What if you hurt yourself? What if you're not successful? What if you don't win? And if that fear is stronger, you can't stay purpose focused. And as long as you're really clear on the why behind it and what this means to you and how it fits into whatever that bigger story for your life is, then those other things just fade away a little bit, because it's like the purpose trumps it.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's awesome. So are you game to play our rapid fire questions?
Sure.
Okay. So the first one is a fill in the blank. Leadership is?
Empowerment.
Oh, I love that one. We haven't had that one before. Who's a leader you admire and why?
So I'll say, you know, a leader that I'm not personally connected to, but somebody that I admire tremendously is Rene Redzepi, who runs Noma Restaurant. You know, they were completely delegitimized. They were mocked at the start of their endeavor, but they had a huge vision of what they wanted to do, and they always stuck to it. They found the people who believed in it. And since then, they've elevated themselves to one of the world's best restaurants, multiple times on the world's best, but they've completely changed the way that people think about culinary. They've changed a lot of techniques and how food is thought about and prepared. And I find that incredibly inspiring to see that journey that he's gone on, how he's inspired people to, you know, prevail through all the ridicule, all the, you know, uncertainty when they were pushing boundaries that nobody would even consider at the time, but they kept to it. And I really admire that in Rene.
Yeah, it goes right back to what we were just talking about, like purpose greater than fear. Like I have a vision and I have like a purpose that I believe in, and like just kept laser focused on that and did not let all the fear step in. And laugh, look what was accomplished. That's awesome.
Exactly.
What are you currently reading?
I just started Subtract. It's by Liddy Klotz. It's the untapped science of less. And I love this idea of kind of subtracting stuff out, making it simpler, making it more, you know, there's this kind of quote where in the simple, there's like the honest, the necessary. And I love that idea, kind of the less is more mantra. So that's a book that I'm currently reading.
I love it. I fell into the KonMari trap a few years ago, where like that whole idea of only having the things that truly spark joy for you, like totally revolutionized how I thought about things. Because, you know, I grew up with the grandmother who was like, oh, it's still good, you should keep it.
Right.
Or, you know, it's still got the tags on, you can't give it away. And when she completely shifted my thinking about, you know, like the joy came in the buying, the joy came when you received the gift, the joy came in another way. And if it's still not giving you that, then it's time to let it go, do that for somebody else. That was so powerful for me, related to that concept of less is more.
Can I throw a question back at you?
Yeah. Yeah.
How did you integrate that into your practice at work, and how you think about like shaping your day to day, shaping teams, strategy?
Ooh, that's a really good question. Cause I really applied it more to the material, physical things. But I will say, like, I really would describe myself as somebody who's very purpose driven. And outside of doing an expense report, I can honestly say that every single thing in my day brings me joy. Like, I don't really have any part of my work, except doing an expense report, that doesn't bring me joy. And so I never really thought about that. But that's a really interesting connection, because I have designed my work like that. Not intentionally, but yeah, good question.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, right? Because as you start to take things away, as you start to just find those things that drive purpose, you lose that resistance from all that baggage that you have, and you can become more laser focused, which I know from your work, you are laser focused. So it makes sense that you've kind of brought over those practices from the material into the more immaterial of management. And
yeah, and you know, the other interesting piece of that I've become more aware of lately, you know, a lot of my work, like, was work that I was doing, you know, as an individual or with one other person. And so it had gotten to a little bit of a point where the coaching work was like tied to my identity, because people were like, oh, Heather, she does the coaching work here. And it was something I was proud of. It was something I was good at. And as I've been able to build a team and transfer some of that work, you know, to somebody else who's even better at it than I am, it is, it's interesting, because at first I felt a little bit of the loss and the angst, because it had become somewhat tied to my identity. But at the same time, the purpose of what I knew that I wanted to do on a larger scale also made me realize, if you hold on to that, you're not going to have capacity to do these other things that you want to do. That will become the thing that limits you if you let it. And so even that shift in thinking made it much, much easier for me to let go of that, even though like it meant that like my name would not be synonymous with that anymore. And it was a successful program. So it was something that was good to be synonymous with, because it had a lot of positive reputation, positive press. But I've noticed that whole purpose piece even related to that.
I love that. That's like such a great story of evolution and growth within the organization and change.
Yeah. I mean, that's been part of my own leadership development journey. Like, what do you want to do next? What else do you have to give to the world? And if you can't let go of this one thing just because you're good at it, doesn't mean like means that you're going to have to sacrifice all that. And it was like, well, no, that's not an option. So if those are if that's my trade-off, then no, I want to let that go to somebody else who can take it further than I did.
That's incredible.
Yes. It's pretty cool. All right. Last one. What do you love about your work?
I love constantly seeing, you know, different challenges that different organizations are facing, how they're facing them, and just the constant diversity in it. Although there's some things that tie a lot of threads together, that, you know, there's some principles. At the end of the day, everyone enacts those differently. Everyone's involved in different contexts. They're kind of jumping into new worlds and kind of helping people navigate through that. That's something that I absolutely love. There's constant change, there's constant, you know, learning, constantly trying to figure out, you know, how to make sense of a different world. And I love that.
That's awesome. And it probably makes sense for why you enjoy doing change work, because it's not for the faint of heart, for sure.
Right.
Related to that, what do you see as the biggest challenge for leaders coming up?
Sure. So from my perspective, I really, I think a lot about how we're going to move knowledge through organizations and start to, you know, bring about change and propagate culture as we start to move to more remote work settings. If we think about more hybrid work settings, we are starting to lose that connectivity within organizations. So I think, you know, previous to, you know, the pandemic, we were able to rely a lot on physical space as a crutch to build networks, build connections, right? If people were around each other all the time, you start to go from very weakly tied people to very strongly tied people, people who are more influential, who are those people who knowledge travels through organizations and who, you know, embody culture and then can pass it on to new people. As we start to thin that out, I think one of the biggest challenges from my perspective for leaders is, how do you become more intentional about creating those connections? How do you make sure that the right parts of organizations are connected so you don't create these silos? How do you allow new people who enter organizations to kind of pick up on the culture of the organization so they go from, you know, colleagues to teammates? And also, how do you start to bring in those practices, right? Oftentimes, we do very aspirational hires. We bring in people who've worked on really interesting projects, people who've done some really great work, and we want to bring that into our organization. So how do we make sure that we're also getting from people and how that they can then propagate those ideas through an organization? Because if they don't have those connections, if they're only weakly tied to their colleagues, those new ideas won't propagate through the organization. And then we lose a lot in those hires. So I think that will be one of the biggest challenges. How do we intentionally create those contexts, those connections between people so that people can feel more connected, they can feel more cohesive and collaborative, and that they can share new ideas, that they can pass through the culture that makes an organization so interesting. Because we don't want to lose that, right? Oftentimes, the culture of an organization is really what drives how we think, act, and how it evolves. So if we start to lose those connections, we really risk that evolution and that passing on those great features of an organization.
Yeah, and you're right. In this new world of work, the intentionality of it is, I think, the thing that will be much, much different. We can't just take it for granted or assume that it will happen because of that crutch of proximity. And that doesn't mean just returning to the office. That's the global world we live in today. I mean, there are colleagues that I work with that I may never see in person.
Right. And oftentimes if we go across organizations into areas that, you know, typically we don't have access to, or typically we don't draw on for inspiration or information, we can really tap really great insights. And if we find ways to move that knowledge through an organization, especially really large ones that are global and multifaceted in nature, we can tap all the knowledge we already have within organizations and start to repurpose that, recombine it across the organization, put it into new contexts and create these incredibly powerful new ideas. So finding those ways to connect that so we can really repurpose all that knowledge that we have internally.
That's a great point. Well, thank you so much, Andreas, for spending time. I mean, I know that you've caused me to think differently in our time today, and I'm sure you have for many of the leaders out there. I hope you'll come back and visit with us again, maybe as we're further along on this journey, and we can talk about what's working and what's not. You can help us figure out where we may have gone wrong.
Thank you so much. It's always great chatting with you. Always happy to share insights and chat with you about them.
Thanks so much. Well, remember, everyone deserves to have a great leader, so keep working at being the best leader you can be. Until next time. This podcast is an original production of Global Talent Management at Herman Miller Group. It's hosted by me, Heather Esposito, and produced in music by Sean Beck.